Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Albaugh. Today, we are really excited to be joined by Alexander Dunlap, who was also at the Exalt Symposium in October of 2020. We're going to get to talk to him about a lot of really interesting topics. I could give a biography, but I'm sure I absolutely won't do it justice. Christopher, do you have anything you want to say before we introduce our guest?
I'm really excited for this talk. His work has already influenced my work quite a bit, especially with the overall views on like the connectedness of extractivisms. And this is definitely one that I've been looking forward to for a while. Welcome to the show, Alexander.
Hello, thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're super happy to have you. And we were hoping that you could start with telling our audience a bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Who am I? Oof, that's a deep question, but right now I'm a postdoctoral research fellow based at the Center for Development and the Environment at the University of Oslo. I have a PhD in social anthropology from the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. And my research focuses on environmental conflicts, specifically around natural resource extraction, but also the construction of energy infrastructure. And I can speak more about the various cases that I have worked on or have endured.
Yeah, we definitely want to hear about some of them. Can you tell us a bit about how you got to this particular niche of research?
I guess I already had a pretty strong background in social struggle and in a lot of different type of kind of conflicts. I guess they tend to be more urban and against the police or against kind of international financial institutions. But it became very clear to me that all roads lead to natural resource extraction. If you're concerned about the direction of industrial society and capitalism, it's going to be a high priority for you to start paying attention to actually the minerals and the extraction that goes on that is pretty much in everything. You know, the copper, the metal, the kind of asphalt, the concrete, steel, you name it, the pipes, everything is coming from somewhere in the earth. And on top of that also is just really is kind of the issue of power. I think a lot of what's even attracted me to academia is really trying to understand what the mess that I grew up in, what I lived in, you know, why skateboarding, the police are constantly chasing me and giving me tickets even when I'm in skate parks. I maybe grew up a certain way that I had to kind of confront society more directly where I always kind of just felt, I mean, in plain terms that society was full of shit and that school was a lie. And so even as I think at around age kind of 6 or 7, just really just being like, wow, like school's, why am I here? I'm not learning anything. And I guess the long answer, and I think is important before any conversation, is that it's really going to be kind of your politics in terms of or how you relate to society as being what's going to underline kind of your engagement with the world and kind of your critique and also what you're concerned about. And I guess this also means kind of what you feel like you need. And I guess for me, I might be... kind of have a more kind of radical approach. And it's because while I'm immersed in the kind of academic culture of computers and emails and energy intensive infrastructure, I've now kind of taken on kind of a technological addiction and also expensive book addiction. I also know I don't really need these things. I think that my priorities are really kind of clean food, good relationships, water. I think cats are really cool and important. But animals in general. And so I know that a lot of the things that I do in my day to day, especially involved with technology, is really substitutes for things I might be lacking in my life. But so overall, I have a background in social struggle and really questioning, you know, how am I stuck in this mess? Why do I have to deal with these laws? Why do I have to deal with these schools? Why are the things that it seemed to be very important being destroyed? And so kind of through this, I saw that kind of energy infrastructure and natural resource extraction were, that's where all the roads lead. And then there came a time when I went to graduate school where I was like, okay, green economy, you know, greening this is, it all seemed very ridiculous. And at the time I was in a class with James Fairhead and the green grabbing kind of special issue came out. And so I was really interested in kind of the farce of kind of the green economy. And I actually had a professor who was publishing really cool stuff and interesting, engaging things. And so this was a surprise for me that, you know, the university could do these things. And so it was from there I really took an interest in developing, you know, what's the reality of the green economy and sustainable development.
Coming off of that, I guess for our listeners at home, like, what is green grabbing? So, I mean, there's always, you know, there's this traditional idea. I mean, especially if you look at so much of Western politics, the magic wand and solution to everything is green energy, green this, green that. So, I mean, what's green grabbing? How could it be bad?
Yeah, no, I mean, so, I mean, green grabbing's funny. So I guess to speak a little more to the term, since it's one of these kind of jargon, I mean, if it, even if it's kind of popular now. So green grabbing is a response to land grabbing. And land grabbing was a response, I guess the way it became popularized was for the kind of the food crisis in 2006, 2007, 2008, where there was a big push to actually start grabbing or acquiring land for different kind of agricultural purposes, specifically biofuels and flex crops, which I believe Marx Kroger at your university has done a lot of really great work on. And, but the thing was, is very quickly it was like, well, and so large scale land acquisitions is the more technical and sanitized and depoliticized term to kind of speak about land grabbing. And, but one of the quick things that came out is like, actually, this isn't very new. You know, this has been going on for a long time. And so one of the quick critiques is that actually, one, land grabbing has been going on a long time, characteristic of colonial endeavors. Two, it doesn't necessarily have to be that large scale, or it doesn't necessarily even have to be from a transnational foreign entity as associated with colonialism. It can actually be done through kind of national governments or corporations, or more common kind of transnational consortiums through kind of multinational configurations. And so how they're grabbing land, forestry resources, agricultural resources, water resources, and these all became water grabs, labor grabs. There became a grab for everything, which I think is justified. And so in part with this is green grabbing. And this was the way of actually grabbing and doing some type of sustainable development project or conservation in the name of doing something under the rubric of environmental ethics and saving the world, or if not saving the world, mitigating climate change or biodiversity loss. And so what kind of came out with the kind of the green grabbing special issue, but also really for the decades of political ecology and later on critical agrarian studies, is that no, these are not green. And a lot of some of the early kind of stuff I worked on and published and also with James was kind of the review article saying that no, a lot of the actual environmental policies that are coming on now related to green grabbing, but also with conservation, with payment for ecosystem services or other so-called market-based, even though they're very much intertwined with public institutions, with the conservation, so biodiversity and renewable energy and all these things, is that no, these are actually increasing environmental degradation. And yeah, Larry Lohman was very good talking about tree plantations and actually how so-called forest conservation was actually being wedded in with subsidies for tree plantations. But no, the green economy and sustainable development is actually increasing environmental degradation. And on top of that, increasing environmental conflicts and also naturally kind of insecurity for people's lives in terms of how they acquire food and live.
I think that's such a good point. Anything that's sold to us, whomever us is, as like a simple solution, or, you know, oh, this is going to be the panacea that saves us all. Like, I think that all of that stuff needs to be so closely interrogated, because it usually isn't as clear cut as the people trying to market it to us would want us to think. Can you give us a more concrete example of some of that infrastructure that could actually cause further damage?
Yeah. No, I'm full of them. I'm an encyclopedia at this point. But maybe even before getting into that, I think it's fun. I don't usually get to talk about green grabbing very often, it seems like, even if I write about it. But one of the kind of the interesting things is actually the idea of ecological distribution conflicts. This was a kind of a concept with Joan Martinez-Allier and James O'Connor that they came up with in 1995. That also is very much related and did a lot of the similar work that kind of green grabbing came to symbolize. And so that one of the fun areas and things is to actually connect these and to show where they're different or how they complement each other, which is something that I've had to do in referee processes, had to point out to me, because I didn't really have anyone in the university to talk to me about ecological distribution conflicts, maybe because I came from a more anthropological background initially. But so yeah, going on with the narrative, I was in graduate school, I learned about the concept green grabbing, and I was actually, to be honest, when I went to graduate school, I didn't really get that much out of it, because I was already reading every type of critical theory that I could. But one the things that I definitely got from it was learning about the post-development school and really being introduced to Ivan Illich, and to somehow that slipped my radar, and then the entire post-development school I found enchanting, even if there's some criticisms, some kind of silly and others useful against that school. And then also I found, you know, the concept of green grabbing, land grabbing, and a lot of the work coming out of critical agrarian studies and the Journal of Peasant Studies, which I like very much. And so in that context, and I had been in Oaxaca right after the insurrection in 2007. And so when I was there, I was looking at kind of human rights abuses and migration patterns between Oaxaca and Oregon at the time. But right when we were leaving, the professor I was with, Jack Corbett, who's a great guy, he's one of these older professors who you can tell when someone's a good developed professor, when they can more or less just start teaching you through cheesy puns or silly stories and jokes. And so I asked him, I was like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm reading about how they're building all these wind turbines south of here, 5 hours. It's like, yeah, everyone's really concerned. They're protesting. They're trying to cover the area with so many wind turbines. And it's an area that's very narrow between the Pacific and the Gulf of Mexico. And he's like, people are really concerned that they're going to build so many wind turbines that it's going to tear the isthmus apart. And at the time I was like, really? But he was really just pulling my leg. But that's kind of when I got introduced to the idea. And so I find myself, I don't know, 5 or 7, maybe 8 years later in graduate school, because I tried to not go to university for a while. And so when I was there and I began committing myself to learning about the kind of the lies of the green economy and sustainable development, I said, you know what, I really miss Mexico. I miss the side of the world that I'm from, because I was in England at the time. And I said, now is a really good time to really get down to understand kind of renewable energy and wind energy development, which I saw as being fundamentally important. Right now it's paraded as one of the biggest solutions to the problems of industrial society and capitalism, and is prominent in the European Green Deal and the Green New Deal. And so, but at the time I knew it would be important. I knew it would be a never dying topic to really get into kind of energy politics and into this type of infrastructure. So I organized my doctoral fieldwork to go and revisit it, because I had different contacts there and friends. And so, yeah, I guess the big awakening for me, of course, I went into this like, okay, I knew there was conflict in the area, some barricade fighting and different things like this. And I knew that there was problems with the sharing of the benefits from wind energy development. And I was pretty rushed. The neoliberal academy doesn't give you much time to breathe and to figure things out. And I also had visa stuff that would deport me from the country if I didn't sort something out. So I moved kind of quickly and went into the field and met friends and talked to them. And I eventually, through kind of different, with friends and different networks, I very quickly ended up into the main and more combative kind of villages in the conflict in the area that were fighting wind energy development. Even my first day, and I think this is in my book, like my first engagement was, I went to the village that kind of rose up for indigenous autonomy. It was Guijarro and Alvaro Obregón. And very quickly, we were in the back of an expropriated police truck. And when there was, I don't know, 8 of us kind of piled in the back of it, because we were in this solidarity caravan by anarchists to kind of go down there. And we went for a drive, but very quickly we were followed by paramilitaries. It was pretty funny, because we were driving out of town and we see this kind of road blockade of some kind of 1990s Ford truck, some guys in blue uniforms with a mask on their face. And this was oddly the one time I saw someone actually with an assault rifle in the area, kind of guarding it. And I was like, and I asked my friend, I was like, who's these guys? Are these the Los Contras? Because that was the slang for the constitutionalists, who were the kind of the faction with the politicians and for the wind turbines. And he was like, yep. And they followed us out there. So we were kind of being followed at a distance. And I wasn't as panicked, because I know that when you're really under attack from police or some type of kind of mercenary force, I already know at that point, they'd be a lot closer and pointing their guns at you. And they kept their distance, but it was kind of still nerve wracking. And I saw other people in the truck getting really nervous. And I was like, ooh, this is bad. And we saw another truck. So yeah, my first day entering this village, we were being followed by paramilitaries. Once we got some distance with them, we had to pull over and start preparing to, in case if they came to attack us. And luckily that didn't happen. But apparently, I guess some wing company people or some type of company were going out there. And so there was, I think, a higher level of security, and hence viewing the assault rifle. But so yeah, so got into that already day one. I found out the kind of the seriousness and the intensity of the conflict, and I was attracted to it, because I kind of had a background for being in some kind of intense places even before going to university. And I committed to them. I embedded myself in the Policia Comunitaria there for some time, and I also was based there and working in other villages that were saturated with wind turbines. and this and there. And it was pretty intense. It was extremely brutal. And because of my kind of commitment and engagement with the police and community, it had consequences in addition to me being, you know, talking very openly about some of the stuff that I broke some of the rules in anthropology about not really supposed to talk about some of your other research findings and things like this. And while I was in a village where the conflict was supposed to be the kind of the most militant and combative of like, we're against wind turbines, kind of this pitching of the struggle is black and white. The reality of these struggles is that they're very complex and that a lot of people care for the land and sea. And there's certainly kind of the kind of the noble fisherman characteristic does exist there. It's just, it's not the majority. And there's many different kind of factions and concerns that tie over with family politics, old political party loyalties, even though they were fragmented by this conflict. And so it was rough, you know, with people kind of shooting in front of my house. But more getting to the point is that what I learned being there is actually how serious the impact wind energy development can be. And there's ways that it can be less impactful and it can be used completely responsibly. And again, I want to stress that I'm a supporter of, I wouldn't call it renewable energy, but I'm a supporter of so-called renewable energy development or fossil fuel plus technologies, as I call them, which maybe we could talk about later. But what I saw there is, you know, very quickly, people were talking about ethnocide, genocide, ecocide. And then this I didn't really expect when I was there. And it didn't become necessarily the focus of my research. I didn't really catch on to that until after a lot of my experiences there. But I really had to look and take seriously what was going on. And I mean, I guess I'll give the breakdown because I think despite my 5 years of talking about this, people still have such a hard time with understanding the severe ecological impacts of kind of wind turbines. But so I guess kind of the summary reflection is that we need to think about wind energy or any type of renewable, so-called renewable energy development in five phases. There's the raw material extraction. There's how is the land contracted or expropriated or grabbed. There's the social, ecological, and economic benefits. There's the what's the energy used for. And then also the decommissioning processes, which are surprisingly gross, and that Benjamin Sovacool did well, and with also my friend Andrea Brock, to talk about some of these things in Ghana and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But what I saw there was shocking. You know, I would go around, there was a very high level of political violence, a very high level of the companies going to these villages. They talk to the politicians, they talk to the landowners. There's huge violations of kind of procedural processes. Actually consulting and asking people, and we're in indigenous territories over there, Zapotec and Akut. So they violate procedures. They try to just kind of run it through local city government, the government to kind of actually run and stabilize the area so they can bring in these projects. They get lots of money. No one knows how much. They distribute it in certain ways to try to stabilize the conflicts. And so people are mad. And the mad is, so I guess it's upsetting in the sense that, you know, people aren't consulted. They don't participate in the project, the planning, or what it's going to be used. In areas not near the lagoon, you have to actually start cutting down trees. You have to make new roads, and you have to. So I guess any impact for wind energy development really depends on the kind of the water table or the hydrology and the geology in the area. And so this is going to be that, and the quantity of wind turbines and where they're placed is going to be kind of some big determining factors. And then there's also mitigation measures that you can do, like painting the turbine with different kind of reflective lights so that birds can see them maybe and not get stuck in the whirlpool and killed. And so there's a series of kind of small things. And I think after a certain kind of intensity or quantity of wind turbines and how they're placed, they don't make that much of a difference, these mitigation measures. But which is to say that placed with not so many, and in certain ways, they can be super useful, and they can empower entire villages or entire regions with maybe not so many, depending on the consumption patterns of where people live. And the consumption patterns, as we know, in southern Mexico are very low. But for the ecological, you have to clear trees, build roads, which compact soil. You have to widen and compact soil of existing roads. You have to go in and dig foundations that are anywhere, depending on the geology, somewhere between 8 to 13 meters deep, and then 16 to 21 or 22 meters wide. You have to fill this with entire concrete and steel. In the case of Oaxaca, you had water, fresh water that was, or it used to be. Now there's big problems with it being kind of dried up, but anywhere from 1 meter to 2 meters below the surface. So there was accessible kind of fresh water that you can drink. And so in this, when they build these foundations, they had to pump it out, put in weird chemicals to actually get rid of the water. And then they're pouring, filling pretty much the veins of the land with concrete and steel. And then you have to build either underground power lines. And this is a whole new kind of infrastructure regime of underground power lines, pylons, transformers, which are all huge. You know, where do the materials of these metals, where do these come from? How are they shipped? Which are big problems. And you build the tower. The tower, what I found out there is that they leak oil. And I think this is more in the older ones. They're going to leak oil into the ground. I've seen oil and water wells of people who didn't, would refuse to sell their land because they appreciated kind of the agrarian culture there so much. And they kill tons of birds. The oil leaks into the ground. I heard lots of accounts of actually cows eating it, getting sick, having fertility problems, and some even dying. And again, these are accounts all. And then on top of this, when you're building these wind turbines around entire villages, I had tons of complaints about sicknesses, cancers, and things that need further investigation. So kind of really serious stuff. And really a lot, all the energy there is being exported out of the region. It's not for the people there. It's the whole area is colonized intensely by wind turbines and energy infrastructure. And it's being transported to different kind of city centers in the area. But, and then many of the parks are owned specifically by Walmart, Grupo Bimbo, which is a big junk food company that sends all the weird plastic. You know, they got their old Twinkies and things like this. Low nutrient food. And there's two mining companies that between them own three wind parks in the area. One of those mining companies I investigated in southern Peru to look at the impacts of copper mining, which is important for energy infrastructure, which is all very connected, and industrial construction companies and so on. So there's a significant ecological impact just by even placing them and running them. A lot of this has to do with the geology, hydrology, and also, you know, the people who live there most importantly. And we've got a lot of semi-subsistent Zapotec and Akut farmers and fishermen live in these areas. And then the issues get much worse when you start building these things near the lagoon and fishing territories, where the big thing is actually the lights, the aircraft warning lights, according to all the fishermen, scare the fish away even once they're built. But in building the foundations and digging them, it actually has big disruptions and vibrations, and fish and different aquatic life are extremely sensitive to vibrations. There's two parks that they tried to build on the Lagoon Superior. There's the one that they first tried on the Barra de Santa Teresa, which was a long sandbar. They wanted to build 102 wind turbines for the Marinho Rebunables project. And this was the one that was militantly resisted by the entire area. But the Alvaro Obregón and Guijarro village was the one where they militantly resisted this. But a lot of the accounts were actually, when they started digging it, just how the fish started going crazy and spinning in circles, and how when they started doing it, they just watched the fish die and come to the surface in great quantities. And I returned last year and have even like deeper ethnographic kind of accounts of how that happened, and even talked to the people who worked for the wind company, who are subcontracted by the wind company to actually do foundation drills to see what types of different natural gas and resources were in the Barra, but also where there would be bedrock. Because there was big rumors, and maybe this is a nice place to kind of air them, is that when I was there the first time in 2015, even a coastal ecologist and many people were saying on the Barra, they actually need to make these foundations 70 meters deep, which means they have to dig out 70 meters of sand, which where they're going to put this, and then they have to fill them with concrete or some type of construction. There was a lot of speculation, but I found out that they actually had to dig the foundations anywhere between 19 and 49 meters deep on this area, according to the people who are on the drill site, which is information I have that I haven't been able to share right in anywhere. Maybe it's a footnote from one of the recent papers I'm working on. But so yeah, there's big impacts. And the thing is, and with the kind of the conclusion in my book and some articles I've written, is when I left this area, I had to take seriously this kind of the question of genocide and ecocide. And it turned out in genocide studies, specifically by Damien Short and kind of Patrick Wolf and also A.D. Moses, there'd been a lot of work actually developing kind of critical genocide theory. And also it's either called post-liberal genocide studies or structural genocide or critical genocide studies, really looking at the seriousness of colonial genocide and doing the work. And one of the key things is this concept of the ecocide genocide nexus, but it's really saying that when you attack the land, when you start destroying and degrading the land and preventing groups who live from them from subsisting from them, you're actually threatening their existence. And that was precisely what I came across when you start actually threatening agrarian culture and degrading it severely, and also destroying the fish population of which people subsisted. And the area is, from UN standards, you know, regarded as abject poverty. And it is that, but at the same time, it's culturally extremely rich. And the qualities and types of seafood, fish and shrimp and crab that you could eat there was amazing. So people could still eat, they could still subsist. They had their mango trees, they had their agriculture and tortillas, which was so valuable to so many people. And these projects on top of the oil refinery, the mining that's actually since then has been more serious, the gas pipelines, the train tracks, the new industrial corridors from AMLO, the current president of Mexico, the region's under constant threat, and the wind turbines were one of them, but also surprisingly and extremely significant. And it's from this, when you threaten people from being able to subsist, it's what are their options? They have to assimilate themselves into the Mexican economy, which means going to go work as agricultural laborers, go and sell drugs and join narco groups, migrate to the US, or go work for the military. And it's so it's creating vulnerability. It's completely altering social fabrics and ecological landscapes. So there's a mouthful.
There is a mouthful, but that's a really good mouthful, because I think that was a beautiful illustration of how a wind turbine is not just a wind turbine. There's, like, you've given us a really good picture of a glimpse into the really complicated web that attends these things. One thing that it's a detail, but I think at least I picked up on it a bit, was wind parks. They call them wind parks. That sounds so like gentle and nice. Oh, it's a wind park. Oh, let's go down to the wind park and, you know, swing or something. So I think that it's just an illustration of how when we're not actually faced with the lived experience and the reality of being near these infrastructure projects, it's easy to maintain a real cognitive dissonance, because, you know, sitting here, not having faced any of the realities that you faced, in my head, I can think, okay, yeah, a wind park. Yeah, that's friendly. I mean, why not? Sure, I'd love to have a wind park. Maybe we can make one in my backyard. No, just joking.
And currently I have an intervention against this. I have a paper that's been kind of held up under review, but in this paper, my friend Martine and I, we're saying, no, these aren't wind parks. These are actually more accurately wind factories, and that we need to refer to them as wind factories because they are creating and zoning things as industrial zones. They are an entire technological apparatus of extraction in terms of harnessing wind energy, which is ultimately really extracting the vital forces of the wind, which is also related to climate change, actually. And there's a problem of this creating velocity deficit is the technical term, which is actually when there's a different flow and vital flow of the wind, the wind turbines are capturing it. And if there's enough of them, they're catching it significantly, which means that there's heat rising behind where wind parks are. And so now there's been modeling stuff for a long time, but now there's empirical data in multiple sites that you have any somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius rise over a span of 10 or 15 years in these areas behind them, from anywhere from 18 to 25 kilometers. But on a personal level, I think it's much worse than that, and it's going to have different rippling effects. But yeah, that's it. That's if we can get into some more of the impacts of kind of green extractivism and it's in the reality of that.
Do you think that one of the issues with this is scale? Like, is a wind turbine as much of a problem as 120?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Scale is the problem in terms of how things are going on. I mean, there's a lot of different problems, but scale is most certainly one. And I mean, you could probably give the entire Isthmus of Tehuantepec power based on 10 wind turbines, you know. I don't know that for sure, but they're very powerful. And again, these big industrial wind turbines can generate a lot of electricity. And if it's for societies that are still semi-subsistent and use very little electricity, then there's an immense amount of possibilities. But as I've been saying lately, the way that so-called renewable or wind energy is being used, and solar as well, is completely irresponsible in terms of what it's being used for.
I mean, all this is so fascinating, especially, you know, you've been studying this in so many different contexts, and this is such a truly global issue. And something I really wanted to ask you about is, since you've been studying this in Europe in various European contexts, and you've been studying this in the Latin American context, what kind of similarities of resistance are you seeing? Like, what are the groups like resisting this? The similarities, the comparison?
Yeah. For specifically kind of energy infrastructure and claims of kind of energy transition and so-called renewable energy. So Oaxaca and France have been kind of the main areas that I've worked that are kind of dealing with similar issues like this. And For me, both are completely different cultures. They're both very different to me. I'm the French are nuts. You know, they're little, that's over my head. The Zapotec culture. I struggle with both the languages severely. And no, but they're extremely different contexts, different cultures. But for they're both people completely valuing and appreciating their land and their territories. And they want to protect them from the imposition of different kind of ultimately the colonization of different infrastructures, whether in the case of the isthmus, it's mostly wind pipelines and all this. And in France, it's more wind turbines, solar. But in the case of France, they're already energy self-sufficient with dams. But sadly, despite like the rich kind of cultural diversity between both these sites and the differences is that the problems that they face are extremely similar and operate by very similar mechanisms of imposition. And so on top of that, we have this kind of governance issue. A lot of people want to write off the Mexico case. Like, oh, but that's Mexico. There's corruption and da, 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 da. I reject this narrative because we're seeing similar things. And so, I mean, the first big difference, I guess, is the intensity of violence is obviously more intense in Mexico. But at the same time, you'd be shocked the amount of resources put into the area in France that I worked. And I mean, maybe to give a little more background, so there's Oaxaca, which we've talked about a bit, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. But I also worked in the Aveyron region of France, and I was invited there because of my work in Mexico and the stuff I did with Andrea Brock in Germany against the Humboldt coal mine. But so there, what they were facing is, so the region already has dams where their energy is self-sufficient. They already, by like 2006, for example, they already had 267 wind turbines or something like that. And the wind turbines have been growing exponentially. But when I was there, I was invited by farmers and rural land defenders and hippies and anarchists and different people, a big diversity of people who've kind of teamed up. And that was also the case in Mexico, where there was a variety of different kind of political factions and people with different kind of ethnicities and identities who've come around saying we can't allow these projects to continue. And in France, it was about a big transformer. And the transformer had two main purposes. It was to enable the increase of more wind and solar projects in the area so they can actually evacuate, as they say, the energy from the area to cities like Toulouse, Montpellier, or maybe through borders to actually trade them for, as the big thing is, energy solidarity within the EU to make sure that there can be more renewable energy in different countries, which is highly related to energy markets and capitalist kind of profit and how they're negotiating these things. So then that leads kind of to the second point, where it's actually it's upping the voltage so you can actually move power very long distances. And a lot of people speculated, and there's claims that this could actually go down into North Africa and Morocco and the Western Sahara conflict, where the Moroccan state is actually grabbing land to build more wind and concentrated solar projects. But that is to be for further investigation. But in France, so that was the issue, this big transformer. So what they did is the woman who was kind of the whistleblower about it was on the city council in 2010. She didn't even know about it. The mayor just signed it. It was a sign of kind of irregular political procedure. Some would say corruption. And they began a civil society group, Plateau Savolte, to stop the project. They began legal proceedings. And this wasn't working, because when you go against the kind of the national imperative of France to build energy infrastructure and renewable energy based, reinforced by climate change legislature, and local politicians who are excited about it, signing the papers without people's consent, then you're going up against the power, you know? In 2015, they decided, and this is farmland in the area. So again, another similarity is that these are agrarian cultures, though very different agrarian cultures. And I think one of the big criticisms of some of the farmers in the Aveyron region is that they're still using pesticides and things like this. But they're still farmers. They still value not having more energy infrastructure in the area. There's already a transformer on the other side of the village. There's all different power lines in the area, and they didn't want more. They're kind of aware. There's already talks of kind of health impacts and people getting tumors and things like this. Again, things that need more investigation. But so they didn't want it. In 2015, they got together with a kind of a very diverse group of people to build the La Massade, which began as a shack, where they would come and have meetings and talk about things. And it went from this one building in this common space to create kind of this commune to expanding to having a big Cobb dormitory, to building greenhouses, to having their own little micro scale wind turbine, water reclamation. So the whole thing was as sustainable as possible and was an open community to actually talk about this, but at the same time, to live in permanent resistance against the transformer. And while between 2015 and 2017, it was kind of a, they call it related to the No Tab movement in Val di Susa in Italy. They call it a presidio, which is kind of a protest site. So no one lived there. It was legal. It's still on the farmer's land, even though it was slated for expropriation. And then there was the declaration of public utility procedure. And so I have an article in Human Geography that speaks about this whole case in depth. So please go there if you want to hear more, because I'm leaving things out. But the DUP, the Declaration of Public Utility Procedure, is saying that this is a public utility. We must have this. So this was signed on the project. This creates an inquiry where they decide, is this an important project? And of course, it was signed despite all the different ways people used to resist it. And so I believe it was in June 2017, the land got expropriated through bureaucratic means. And this, then La Mesad, all of a sudden around all the roads and everywhere, barricades were erected and formed everywhere, and it turned in. And while it was always associated, it officially joined the Zone de Fond constellation in France. And the Zone de Fond is the Zone to Defend, or the ZAD, which was made very popular in 2012, or it began much earlier in 2007, but with the Notre Dame de Lons struggle against the mega airport just north of Nantes. And since Notre Dame de Lons in this struggle that became very big and ultimately succeeded, even though it could have succeeded better, there became a proliferation of ZADs fighting all sorts of different big and what they say useless mega projects that are not leading to a better and healthier world. And what's important about La Mesad is that this was actually a big and direct intervention against the green economy and energy extraction and so-called energy transition, in the name of having real ecological transition, in the name of having real energy transition. So yeah, and so that began that struggle. You had to wear masks, there was barricades, and they experienced, while it wasn't kind of, there was a bit of like kind of a pistolero or kind of gunman and kind of, you could say, organized crime politics that meshed with the politicians in Mexico and things like this. But not that, and there was still these kind of problems of the police. They were flying helicopters around them. There's checks. There was constant surveillance. There's a game of cat and mouse in France of kind of trying to avoid them. And eventually the place was evicted with 200 riot police, two armored transport tanks, and two tractors to tear the place down. And so that while there wasn't shootings and there wasn't big barricade fighting as there was in Oaxaca, and assassinations and killings, I think there's been at least somewhere from 8 deaths related to resisting mega projects, and even more woundings in Oaxaca. There haven't been any direct deaths in the Aveyron. I think in the ZAD struggles, there's been one person who was killed in the Sivens Dam struggle. But so there weren't any deaths, but there is still this an immense amount of resources dedicated for having special anti-terrorism task force units in the area, constant surveillance. This included helicopters flying over La Mesad, but also the different houses of people where they lived in this village. And a lot of it was all just nonviolent direct action in terms of, you know, living in place, holding up banners, doing disrupting different events and things like this. And maybe some vandalism and spray paint would come up. But this, where this came from, there's so many people in the area who was against this project. But yeah, so there's differences, intensity of violence, culture, geographic location and region, different types of farmers, but there is still a variety of different kind of, I guess the similarities are that you see politicians and specific landowners as key points of intervention to kind of force through these projects. This is the same. You see many different people kind of organizing and mobilizing against to kind of protect their territories or land base. You're still seeing high levels of repression, even if the violence is more extreme in different contexts. And yeah, it's really the same story when people resist and are trying to protect their territory. And there's also internal divisions about, you know, what strategies you use to fight these. And so meanwhile, the states are engaged in not only having riot police and different kind of intimidation, but they're trying to come up with different kind of carrot strategies or soft kind of counterinsurgency strategies to to divide them, to get people to think on themselves. And both also had this idea of kind of sustainable development, going green, helping climate change, is kind of big kind of discursive forces trying to kind of support these projects. So I think there's some more similarities and some more differences, but this is what comes to mind in this moment.
That is amazing. I can't believe that even with such different contexts, there's so many similarities. And I mean, you did a very good job of illustrating the differences, but really those similarities resonate with me, because I think sometimes when we do get really good insight into what's happening in a particular situation, I think one of the ways that it can be detracted or dismissed is to say like, oh, well, that's just that context. So it's really interesting to hear that there's so many threads that connect between the Mexico situation and what you've seen in France and Germany and those places. When you were talking, you mentioned something that was called Fossil Fuel Plus, and I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about what that is and what it means.
Yes, yes, I'd love to. So the term Fossil Fuel Plus is really a reaction to the idea of, you know, is making a jab at this idea of renewable energy, and to actually say, well, now that we've lived around wind turbines and they're distinct, I mean, you don't have to be very, you can just look at them. They're giant kind of metal spinning robots full of different gears and kind of metals and things like this. It's what's really green, what's really renewable or sustainable about these things. And so the idea of Fossil Fuel Plus was me to really think like, I mean, it's specifically a reaction to a lot of my climate justice friends that when I in Amsterdam, they would just talk about fossil fuels. I mean, they just, all they care is about fossil fuels, which makes sense. There's a lot of problems with fossil fuels and hydrocarbon extraction. But for me, I saw a lot of problems with just focusing on that. And so I came up with the term Fossil Fuel Plus to try to communicate to my environmentalist friends that the question is bigger than fossil fuels. And the idea is that actually, when you look behind so-called renewable energy technologies, we know specifically wind or solar, there's an entire supply chain, or more accurately supply web, that is extremely complicated and very murky and really glossed over by these kind of life cycle assessment modeling kind of exercises and the data that they're drawing on. And so the idea is that no, not a single thing is renewable about this. Actually, everything, no matter how you look at it, is based and operating on hydrocarbons and hydrocarbon extraction and fossil fuels. And this means that, you know, the factories to build the machines, do the mining and the transporting of the iron ore or the different kind of ores for mineral extraction, it's all based on hydrocarbons. All the mining procedures and operations are based on hydrocarbons. All the assembly lines and mechanics to go to the processing facility is based on hydrocarbons. All the smelting is based on choke coal, which is a big deal, you know. So, and then so on to the manufacturing and with the transport, all the way down to the wind turbine running, it leaks oil, you know, they require hydrocarbons. So the idea is that a Fossil Fuel Plus is, this is actually a more accurate term to describe renewable energy. And in my, it's, to be honest, it's a bit generous, because there's the fossil fuel and then the plus to actually signify the renewable energy extraction. So I'm trying to be positive about saying that it's plus, it's better. You can get more wind and solar resources, but in reality, and especially in the way that it's at, these renewable energy systems are being deployed right now, or these fossil fuel plus technologies, is that no, they're just extracting more resources on top of all the other resources they're extracting. I mean, and right now, the ideal behind this kind of claim of energy transition and renewable energy is that, oh, we're going to run this all on renewable energy, whether it be hydro and things like this. And I think there's cases maybe in Sweden where there's smelters run on kind of on dams and hydrological resources. Now you have mining companies. They love getting on the renewable energy bandwagon. And they've got giant dump trucks based on electric technologies. And mining is done through digital technologies and automation. So this is also brings in labor issues and things like this. But again, it's this doubling down of more extraction, more rare earth minerals, more smart technologies that are insane. So, but I think the utopian idea is that you just mine and destroy the earth enough so you have so many smart technologies and things like this that you could say it's done renewably. But I the question is how much do you have to destroy to do that? And really that question's pointless, because it's not going that way. You know, there's the natural gas, the different kind of, I mean, gas, nuclear, these things are still on the table, even if in some countries they're trying to phase them out. there's every type of investment in all these other different types of ways. So the renewable energy is just an addition. And really, if you look at the historical work, there's no such thing as energy transition. And so far under capitalism, it's just been addition, addition, addition for more consumption, more growth, more consumption of natural resources. And so I guess when I wrote is that there's the issue of decommissioning and that these things only last somewhere between 25 and 30 years. And if you do retrofitting, you can get them up to maybe 40 years or a little more. And so you have to recycle these things. This gets into rates of recycling, and the rates of recycling are extremely low. And oddly, it's the World Bank that has been very honest about the rates of recycling for these things. And currently, as of like a 2020 report, aluminum is, I mean, and there's different ways of looking at recycling. There's end of life, and then there's recycled content. And recycled content means the amount you can actually use from it. And so for aluminum, for example, it's only between 36%, and cobalt is 32%. Copper is only between 20 and 37%. Lithium is less than 1%. And so this is related to battery technologies. And nickel is between 29 and 41%. And a lot of these are actually, and this is just the recycling aspect, because a lot of when you talk about recycling aluminum and things like this, or different iron ores, they're going to be in different kind of existing infrastructures. So it means you're going to have to mine more with the different kind of energy transition claim. So really there's a push for consuming everything. And I think this, I don't think this is the right direction.
Thank you all for tuning in and listening. And thank you to Alexander Dunlap for coming on the show. We had such a fantastic time talking about so many different topics that we actually lost track of time. So we've made the editorial decision to split this one into two separate episodes. So please tune in for our bonus episode with Alexander Dunlap, where we talk about the conceptualization of the world eater and how extractivisms and our economic systems come together to entangle ourselves and our environment. And also, we'll be tackling the question. And of course, after the bonus episode, at the end of next month, we will be back again with a new interview with Yaffa Al-Masri, where we'll be talking about how refugees can save the world. From the frozen seas of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for tuning in, stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.